Okay, well, thank you very much for inviting us to speak at the seminar. The stuff we're going to talk about is a continuation of work in a series of papers by, among others, Mina, Sergey, and Mashra and I. And the next iteration should hopefully be out in the near future with some of the material that we're going to talk about. So, in very broad outline, what we're going to talk about is mechanisms for energy extraction from astrophysical black holes and how we can use these to probe hypothetical new particles. So we'll go over the energy extraction mechanisms and how these work for new light scalar vector particles. The new part of this talk is basically the vector bit. And then Mashra will talk about the possible observational signatures that you might be able to use to discover these with real black holes in the sky somewhere. Including gravitational radiation, which, given that LIGO is now starting to do its thing, is pretty timely. Okay, so a very quick motivation. Like I said, the sort of overall idea behind this stuff is we're going to try and look for new, we're going to try and use these black holes to look for new particles. What kind of new particles? In particular, very light but weakly coupled ones. So we have a standard model, and then new stuff could either be heavy enough that we haven't seen it yet, but still strongly coupled, like the stuff the LHC is searching for, or grand unified stuff at very high scales. But it's also possible that there is new stuff at energies that we certainly have access to, but just so weakly coupled that we have not seen it yet. Axions, new light vectors or scalars with very small couplings, those kind of things occur in many models of beyond standard model physics, and looking for them demands very different techniques to the usual collider heavy program on the other end. So yeah, black hole supergradients is going to probe exactly this region down to extremely small couplings. In fact, purely we're only going to rely on purely gravitational couplings of these new particles in this book. So yeah, you're looking at excluding or finding stuff in this kind of regime. Okay, so on to how we're going to do this. We're going to use spinning black holes. So since this is a strong gravity group, I will go through all this stuff fairly quickly. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about here. But okay, so a Kerr black hole has an ergosphere, a region where particles can have negative energy as viewed from infinity. And the first way people came up with of using this to extract energy from the black holes was the mechanical Penrose process. So you throw in some particle, you split it into two. One of the negative energy part goes into the black hole. The other part makes its way out. And they bestow more energy than in the outgoing thing than you sent in to start with. And now the black hole has spun down a bit, and it's got a little bit less massive. So this process also has a wave analog. You send in some wave. The transmitted wave now has a negative energy as seen from infinity, and the reflected wave carries extra energy away. And this kind of stuff has been known about since the 70s. People worked out what the amplification factor you can get for photon waves or graviton waves sending into a black hole is. And the form of the energy extraction is actually pretty simple. If you have some wave with an angular quantum number n, then whether you extract energy or not just depends on the frequency of the wave minus m times the angular velocity of the horizon. Basically, whether the phase velocity of the wave around the horizon is faster or slower than the speed at which the black hole is rotating. If it's slower, then the black hole effectively gives up some of its spin and boosts the wave. So, but this is just a one-pass thing. If you send in a photon wave or a graviton wave, so just light or gravitational radiation, then you get some amplification factor, but then it just goes off to infinity. You get a one-shot boost. So how might you try and do more than that? So again, back in the 70s, there was the black hole bomb thought experiment. Suppose that you put a mirror around a black hole and we send in, say, some wave packet of photons. Then it parts of the black hole gets amplified by the superradiance process, but then the mirror reverses its direction, sends it back, it bounces back, gets amplified again, and then this will happen again and again. You get an exponential amplification of your initial wave packet. extracting more and more energy and angular momentum from the black hole. So that's a nice thought experiment, but the realization a while ago in a paper by Detweiler and Variously, I can't exactly remember the history, but what basically we realize is that actually, if you have a particle with a mass, then the mass means that it can form bound states around the black hole. Effectively, that's your mirror. And then it can, interacting near the horizon, it can extract energy and angular momentum of the black hole, again, exponentially increasing the occupation number and extracting more and more energy and angular momentum from this black hole. So this is the process that we're going to focus on. So, okay, how does this work on a quantitative level? So if your particle has a mass that's small compared to the black hole, then the bound states around the black hole look basically hydrogen-like. So we have an equivalent of a fine structure constant, which is basically the radius of the black hole, well, the gravitational radius times the mass. We have the usual energy levels. We have the usual approximate size of the cloud, which this number is just what's going to turn out to be it for the numbers we're looking at. And you have the usual hydrogen-like orbitals. So and it's going to turn out that, yeah, since we could only get super radiance for things which had some angular quantum number m, for a scalar wave, we don't actually want to look at the S wave thing. So we want to look at all these other orbitals. For vector, we again have hydrogen-like orbitals, but we don't just have a scalar value, we have a vector value at each point. So that means that our angular profile now is a vector spherical harmonic rather than a scalar spherical harmonic. And the key difference there is that since the vector has intrinsic spin, the total angular momentum of the state is now got an extra part as well as the orbital angular momentum. So this shows the same total angular momentum of the state, the three different orbital angular momentum possibilities. So if we just set these going. So this is. No, this is just, this could be orbits around a Schwarzschild black hole, right?
Okay,
so there's no, this is just what the orbits look like in a 1 over r potential.
The projection, the J component is up.
Yes, so in particular, yes, these all have m equals 1, so it's the total angular momentum is in the z direction upwards. And you can see they're all spinning around that axis. So you can see that we can have angular momentum 1, and so growing that mode would extract energy from the energy and angular momentum from the black hole, but we can still have L equals 0, so it's localized near the horizon. Then we've got these other more complicated looking modes, which don't. Okay, so how does the superradiant growth, how does growing these states work? So for a scalar field, go through a scalar example to start with, to compare, because that's simpler, and to compare it to the vector. You can estimate the rate of growth pretty simply. It's basically just area, so the energy flux across the horizon is roughly area horizon times the scalar field value near the horizon, squared occupation, energy density near the horizon, times this factor, times the frequency. So if we take a small, so if we work this out in terms of the hydrogen-like orbital parameters, so our fine structure constant, which goes as the mass of the particle, then that's telling us that for smaller fine structure constants, so for smaller masses, and for larger L, the smaller the growth rate. Basically, the cloud is going to be localized further away from the black hole. The value near the horizon is smaller for larger L and for smaller mass, so we manage to extract energy at a smaller rate. So this is a plot of basically the growth rate relative to the fine structure constant. You can read this as, if we keep the black hole mass constant, the mass of our new particle. So the L equals 1 mode is got a higher rate of energy extraction than L equals 2, L equals 3, L equals 4. And the fastest growth rate is for the particle mass around the inverse size of the black hole. If we take the particle mass too large, then this term flips sign, and we stop getting superradiance at all. So that's these cutoffs here. But if we take the mass too small, then this term comes in and kills us. So the fastest growth rate is when the quantum wavelength is roughly of order the size of the black hole. There we go. Yeah, so these are the cutoffs. Okay, so for a vector, it turns out that the story is a little bit different. So if we take J is L plus S, where S is minus 1, 0, or plus 1, then the growth rate goes as 4L plus 2S plus 4 times this. So for a scalar, it was just 4L plus 4. Here we have this extra factor. So if we put that in terms of L and J, it's 2L plus 2J plus 4. So people had noticed this previously numerically, just doing simulations around structured and curve space-times, but hadn't been able to sort of see why this was happening. So, but you can see where this comes from by basically doing a wave function matching argument. So far away from the black hole, like I said, the thing looks hydrogen-like. We're effectively in a 1 over r potential, so you get a hydrogen-like wave function. Very close to the black hole, the mass of the particle becomes negligible, becomes unimportant for the equation of motion. For example, if we took the effective potential for a scalar around a black hole, then that effective potential depends on LL plus 1 over r squared, this, and then the mass comes in as this mu squared here. So we see that for mu, much less than the inverse, r much less than the inverse mass, the mass term is less important than the other terms in this equation. So effectively, your wave function ends up looking a bit like this. You've got some bound state further out that looks hydrogen-like, but very close to the horizon, you have something that looks like the equation for a massless particle. You have a wave that's just ingoing to the horizon. And the key point is that there is a regime in the middle where both of these approximations hold the leading order in alpha, where r is, we're assuming that our fine structure constant is small. So we have our alpha. Can anyone see that? Because I can't see it. Okay, that's a bad idea.
Yeah.
So we have that our fine structure constant, which was basically the ratio of the mass, so the quantum wavelength of the particle and the size of the black hole, the quantum wavelength of the particle is much larger than the size of the black hole, then we have this regime where r is still much larger than the size of the black hole, but still much smaller than the quantum wavelength of the particle. In that regime, the leading order, both these approximations work, and we can match between them. Yes.
So the potential is
in tortoise r. Sorry? Is
tortoise r.
Oh, r star is tortoise r, yes.
And maybe the potential of r is
tortoise. No, r here is real. R here is the actual r. I'm putting it in terms of tortoise coordinate just because in that thing, the massless form just becomes a e to the I k r star. Yeah. So, yeah, so for those who, so r star is the tortoise coordinate. So far away, it just looks like normal r, near to the horizon. So it goes off to infinity, minus infinity, and the horizon is at minus infinity.
I'm just confused because for mu of order g, then mu squared of the same order. It's this other term there.
So yeah, so for the... Yeah, so we're saying that for mu is much... mu to the minus 1 is much greater than rg because we're assuming alpha is small. We're saying this is an approximation that only works in the small alpha limit.
Okay.
So we can do an analytic matching in the small alpha limit. We can't do anything in the limit where things are properly relativistic. We don't have a handle on that. But in this limit, we do. Okay, and effectively, where the two, we can see from this where the 2L plus 2J is coming from. The value of the wave, the hydrogen-like wave function near the origin is set by L. This is where our 2L is coming from. But for a vector, the absorption of a massless vector is controlled by the total angular momentum j. So we get the factor 2j from there. So back in the 70s, people worked out what the absorption probability for a massless boson of general spin is. Turns out to be this thing involving the spin s of the boson. So scalar is s equals 0, vector is s equals 1. So you have this prefactor out front. And then the rest of it is some complicated function of spin, but with a sign controlled by the usual omega minus m angular velocity of horizon term, and then the frequency to the power 2j plus 1. So for a scalar, l and j are the same, so we get the 2l plus 1 here. For a vector, we get 2j plus 1. The story is slightly more complicated than that, in that what we've got is a massive vector field. And in the limit where that mass is small compared to the other terms of interest, a massive vector field doesn't look like a photon. It looks like two transverse components and one longitudinal component. So two components that look like a photon and one component that looks like a light scalar. So actually what we need to do is we need to match onto light, so a effectively transverse and longitudinal components. And both of those can contribute to extracting energy from the black hole. But the massive, the scalar component corresponds to the time-like part of the vector field. And because in the proper equation, we have the Lorentz condition holding, this can be related, we can relate this to the spatial components. And we get an extra suppression from that. Because in the hydrogen-like so for a hydrogen-like wave function, the momentum is low, so we're effectively A0 is velocity suppressed compared to the AI. So putting all those things together, we find that the scalar mode actually only contributes at the same order in one case and the subleading order in other cases. For example, except in one case, the monopole mode, so the J equals 0, L equals 1 mode, that falls in entirely through the scalar mode. There's no J equals 0 massless vector mode. And there, you can work out the rate at which it falls in like that. Okay, so putting all of these things together, we can get analytic forms in the small alpha limit for the growth rates of the different vector bound states. So for each J, we have L equals J minus 1, L equals J, and L equals J plus 1. In these two cases, we doing the matching, we find that we're dominantly extracting energy and angular momentum through the transverse, the massless vector states, matching onto those in the small r regime. For the L equals J plus 1, it dominantly falls in through the massless scalar part with some numerically subleading contribution vector. But yeah, you get some answers. In particular, for the J equals 0, this one doesn't carry any angular momentum, so it can't actually have a positive growth rate. So this one falls in, and the rest of them, we're taking the m equals 1 part here, like Masha said. So these all have positive growth rates. They extract energy and angular momentum from the black hole. So the sort of key points here are that, for comparison, the scalar had fastest growth rate that went as alpha to the 8 times the spin of the black hole, times the mass. Here, the fastest growing mode grows like alpha to the 6th. So in the small alpha limit, this one will grow significantly faster than the scalar case. So vectors stand a chance to be built up around black holes significantly quicker than scalars do. Also, in the scalar case, the leading fall-in actually goes as alpha to the 5. Whereas here, the leading rate at which we can fall in is, if we flip the sign of this one, alpha to the 6th. Again, so it's more robust to perturbations. If you had a perturbation that mixed the scalar growing mode with the scalar decaying mode, then since the decaying mode falls in faster than the growing mode grows, you only need a small perturbation to mess up this growth. In the vector case, you have slightly more leeway. It's harder for mixing between the modes to destroy the growth of these things. Okay, so looking at how this compares to some preliminary results that Will here has been doing. So this is the growth rate. This is our fine structure constant alpha. So the vector results are in blue. The scalar, so people have done numerical results for the scalar case as well. The scalar case is in green. So we see that, as expected, the scalar case, we have significantly smaller growth. And we have approximately the same relation between our first order in alpha analytic approximation for the scalar case as we do in the vector case. If we extrapolate this downwards, this does appear to be going as the correct power output of the six. And it is pretty much, it looks to be matching up with the slope and intercept we carry on this down pretty much correctly. The scalar case seems to converge a bit quicker, but gives you some confidence that it's behaving reasonably well.
So this is the J equals 1 mode.
So this is the fastest growing mode in both cases. So this is the J
equals 1, L equals 1 mode.
So for this, for the vector, it's the J equals 1, L equals 0. Yeah. So it's the one that has most support closest to the black hole, but still has angular momentum. And for the scalar case, it's just the L equals 1 mode. Sorry, what's that?
We'll get one and we get
four thirds. But as you can tell, it's not necessarily converged by this point.
No, it's okay. If I ignore it, what it might say at the large output. Supported one?
On this plot, yes.
Yes, so it's the same plot.
Yeah. Yes. So they both look like output of the sixth down here, and then the number in front of that is within sort of 30% or so. We haven't tried to do a higher order in alpha expansion. You could do that. It just becomes more complicated. It may well be just that the next order in alpha term has a higher numerical value in this case. That would be the minimum explanation. I don't know if it's true because we haven't actually done a full. We do have some. You can easily compute some next to leading order in alpha terms, but doing it properly is more difficult. So like I said, this analytic expression is accurate to leading order in alpha for a given spin. In particular, it's not a small spin approximation. This is a spin of 0.99. So some previous work that's been done by other people looked at making the expansion about Schwarzschild. So you start a spin of zero, then expand around that, and look at the proper equation there. This is just an expansion in small mass of these vector bound states. So we can try and look at the high spins that are going to turn out to be most relevant for phenomenology and actually finding these things out in the universe. So on that note, I will pass over to Masha, who will talk about finding these things out in the universe. And oh yes, any questions on the on this part? Yes, so Will has got some preliminary results for the next level, which we will compare to once those have all firmed up a bit. And in the scalar case, you can easily plot the next level. You can see that it looks pretty similar, and so on and so forth.
The problem with, well, I guess we'll answer this question, but for numerics, it's much harder to get the rates because they're slow. So it's going to be harder for us to extrapolate down to small values and compare there.
I mean, so the difference between these two numerical things is that Will's simulation is in the time domain. In the scalar case, you can separate out the equation and just look at solving a one-dimensional equation, basically in the frequency domain. That makes things much, much simpler, and they can go down to smaller alpha, and it's much easier. The vector case is more. Yeah.
Compared to the work at small spin?
Yes.
So yes. In particular, there is, in the Schwarzschild case, there are numerical, the equation does separate there. You're just solving a one-dimensional equation. There are quite nice numerical results in that case. And comparing to those, we match pretty well. The expansion about Schwarzschild, there are some issues there in particular. The comparison is slightly complicated, but it appears that they get rather different rates, even in the small alpha limit. That disagrees with our answer and with Will's simulations. We will attempt to see if we can understand why, but I don't think we understand that at the moment. Yep.
Practical question. Can we have a black hole spinning close to speed of light?
So the A star here is the ratio of the black hole spin to the maximum allowed spin for its mass. The maximum allowed spin is in some sense the horizon spinning at the speed of light. in some extremely watchy sense.
So yeah, A star equals one in these units is a extremal curve black hole. And I'll show you some data to give you a sense of what's actually been measured out in.
The closest we have is Sagittarius A star. Stimulations have shown that it has probably has a spin of 0.6.
Okay, but actually, as Masha will say, measurements of smaller black holes show that some of them have much higher spins. Some of those have spins which are almost extremal. But Masha will show some plots of these, surely.
Stellar black
holes. Yes,
stellar mass black holes. Yes. Some of those have much higher spins.
They've been observed.
Yes, in X-ray binary systems, but we'll get into that in a very short while.
And similarly, for supermassive black holes, there are some that depend on high spins.
The mathematical solution, Riesen-Ostrom solution, has two horizons.
Right.
So, such a thing, if you have a negligible electric charge, you lower the black hole apart, it neutralizes very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And let's ignore that.
Okay.
So, if you use that, what do you get for super radiance?
Well, in particular, yes, you can have super, you can certainly have super radiance around charged black holes. We're working in the limit of spinning black holes, but Stephen, for example, has done some very nice simulations of super radiance around the Riesen-Ostrom black hole. So I think ask Stephen on that front. We've just looked at Kerr, we haven't looked at charged black holes, because astrophysically you don't expect to have the charge to be formed.
No.
But you do get super radiance there.
It's just ideally, it's interesting.
Yeah.
This is such a talk to Stephen.
And it can be easier to simulate in some cases.
Yes.
So it's a very good example to think about. Okay, so all right. So now you guys know everything you want to know about the details of vectors growing around black holes. So let's see how this can apply, like Robert said, to real astrophysical systems. So here we're going to be imagining that we have a new light particle beyond the standard model, either a scalar or a vector. I'll mostly focus on the vectors. And let's see if we can observe them around real black holes. So here I'm showing a plot where we have a black hole spin on the y-axis. Can you see this? Okay, well, black hole spin on the y-axis and black hole mass and solar masses on the x-axis. And again, we are going from zero is Schwarzschild, then one is extremal curve. And the blue regions here are exactly corresponding to the super radiance regions that Robert talked about. So these lines on the right are where the L equals 1, L equals 2, or I should say more generally, J equals 1, total angular momentum 1, 2, and 3 regions have their super radiance boundary in this plane. So if the black hole spin is high enough, then you get super radiance. If it's too low, you don't. And then the curves turn over if superradiance is too slow. So if the black hole mass is too light, so the coupling to this particle, which I've picked to be 6 × 10⁻³ EV, is too weak, then the rates are just too slow. And what too slow means, I'll quantify in a second. OK, so let's say we have a black hole that's born with a high spin, 0.95, and a large mass, 40 solar masses. In about 10 years, it'll drop down in mostly in the spin direction. And it'll lose most of its spin to a bunch of particles around it in a level that looks like a 2p orbital.
Here you're using the...
This is scalars. This is for scalars. So then at this point, it's on the super radiance condition line. So the angular velocity of the black hole exactly matches the angular velocity of the particles in this level. And the level has 10 to the 77th particles. And that's just saying we had a black hole with a large amount of angular momentum, and the amount of angular momentum it has lost is about 10 to the 77 fundamental units. So each one of these particles carries one of the H bars of the black hole's momentum. At this point, this level no longer satisfies the super radiance condition, so the super radiance shuts off. And so the level stops growing, and the instability has effectively saturated. Then, but The next level, the one that's localized further away from the black hole at this point, is growing. And as Robert explained, this one grows much slower. Now, instead of taking 10 years to drop down an equivalent jump and spin, now it's going to take about a million years because now we have L equals 2 and the level is localized much further from the black hole. In the meantime, while this level is growing, the innermost level is going to be annihilating away to gravitational wave radiation, which will be one of the signals that I'll get to in the end. And finally, at the end here, it's been 10 to the 6 years, and effectively the black hole stops evolving. In principle, the third level here could come down and start to grow. You can sort of see it out there. But if that rate is going to be much too slow to be observed, it's going to be longer than the age of the black hole, or maybe even longer than the age of the universe. So in terms of observational purposes, it's not. The process stops here.
In this plot, what's your lower bound for masses, tensor
masses? Zero.
Zero.
Yeah, here, this point.
So it goes from zero. Yeah, but I mean, there's a gap.
This is just plotting artifact, I think. So yeah, I'm plotting it from 0 to 160, I think, here.
So I'm interested in, is the curve, if I start at 0 or 1 sort of mass black hole,
yeah.
Is the curve that rises?
Oh yeah, this curve goes back up. Yeah, I'll show more pictures later where you can see the full thing. But yeah, it'll have a similar shape to this.
So X-ray binders that are observed.
Yes, I'll get there. This is a very good question. Was there another question?
Oh, I was going to say, so during the second phase, do the particles that came out originally, did they fall back?
Yes, in principle, they would, but they tend to annihilate away faster than the next level grows. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yes?
If you start with a, say, Lona black hole,
yeah.
Then that means that this is correct. You wouldn't observe low mass black holes, highly spinning.
Yes. Good. Everyone's getting it. Great. Good. Okay. So now comparing to the spin one, like we learned earlier, spin one rates are much more efficient. And so instead, now these curves can go down the lower black hole masses. And in particular, these times are much faster. So instead of taking 10 years, you drop down in a couple of days. And then here you get down to this point in 10 to the 3 years. Still to finish spinning down, you need a bit of a longer time. And the reason, again, is that now we can play with the total and orbital angular momentum separately. So for the scalar, you're forced to have J equals L. And here you have J equals 1, L equals 1. But for the vector, you can have J equals 1, L equals 0. The L equals 0 state is localized closer to the black hole, and it's much more efficient at extracting the spin, so everything just goes faster. All right, so this is just to summarize, the general idea is that we're going to be using these black holes, like some of you are already anticipating, to constrain and look for new light particles. The mass range is here. It's set by the sizes of black holes that we see in the universe, both stellar mass and supermassive. And these are the types of things we want to look for, scalars or vectors with a mass. And the rest of the interactions are not important as long as they're very weak. And the nice thing is that this is independent of any background density. So even though some of these light particles are excellent dark matter candidates, we don't have to rely on that for super radiance to start and build up these clouds.
So you're talking about these as particles?
Yes. Yes.
And so you're populating this wave function. It's having an increased amount of energy. You don't actually have particle states and unclocks. It's very important.
It is in the case where we're building up a very huge occupation number of these, so we can treat them as classical state.
You expect to build up a coherent state with a definite phase of oscillation. You don't expect to build up a non state. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to the observation. So the first one, the clearest, is the spin down of black holes. So like you perhaps were saying, this is again the same plot with the mass and spin of the black hole here. And now I'm going from 432 to 20 solar masses, and I've picked a particle that's a bit heavier than the previous one, so you see the region looks different. It's at smaller, at lighter black hole masses. But these are the same superradiance curves now for this particle mass, center of the minus 11 EV. And blue is scalar, pink is vector. And you can see that there's already measurements. These come from X-ray binaries, where you have a black hole and a stellar companion. And you look at the accretion disk nearby the black hole and try to extract the spin information from there. And you can see that four of these black holes already disfavor this scalar mass, and five of them disfavor the vector mass as well. As you change the mass of the particle, these regions shift to the right to heavier black holes. And so here you see that even more of these measurements start constraining this mass. As you go to even lighter particle masses, these superradiance regions shift off to the right. Here, superradiance for scalars is too slow for 10 to minus 13 EV. It's too slow for scalars to affect any of these black holes, but it's still fast enough for vectors. So this is still constrained if it's a vector particle. So if we combine all these measurements together, these are some all the results I'm showing are preliminary, so just a side note there. But the big picture should be correct. So we have five measurements of stellar mass black holes that are rapidly spinning, and four measurements of supermassive black holes. And these combine to set roughly 2 and 3 orders of magnitude of exclusion in light vectors. And you can see that here, basically all of the black holes fall on top of each other. So we're pretty confident that this region is, in fact, excluded. Yes?
Those 2 at 15 solar masses.
The black holes at 15 solar masses?
Uh-huh. They're controversial.
They're controversial, these ones?
That one there is some serious problems with the progenitor stuff.
What are the problems?
Okay.
Well, yeah, maybe. Okay. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely. I mean, these measurements are sort of a growing field. There's two for stellar mass black holes. There's two different techniques with which you can do the measurements, and we take the most conservative combination of all of them. Yeah. And but as you can see, if you're unhappy with one of the black holes, so you can just toss it out. But I'm pretty sure that I'm fairly confident as in the measurements and the uncertainties there.
So this is a little bit in bold, but if you add that you don't have spins of very solar masses, what do you say?
If you don't what?
If you don't have black hole spinning up to very solar masses.
We'll get there. I think we'll get there if that's the question I think you're asking. Okay. All right. So this is the constraint. And that's all good, but we also want to try to discover new things. So we thankfully we have a big new data set that's coming, hopefully. LIGO has already found 6 new black holes that we didn't know about before. And given those rates, we expect between tens and hundreds of binary black hole mergers per gigaparsec cube per year. This means that at design sensitivity, LIGO will hopefully be finding of order 1 new merger every few days or even more. So we'll get a lot of new spin and mass measurements to play with. And this is something that this is a spin mass distribution that is a guess at what these measurements could look like in the absence of these new particles. Now let's say we have a new light vector and we're picking it to be at a mass that's below the excluded region I was showing you before. The plot would change like this. So if you start with the 2 black holes that are merging, and you give them roughly 10 billion years to merge, this will spin down a majority of the black holes to very low spins, up to 50, or basically up to all the black hole masses that LIGO will be able to measure. And these are the, These are the J equals 1 and J equals 2 levels for the vector state. Of course, LIGO is not going to be able to measure something like this because their spin errors are quite large. What they'll actually see is something that looks more like that, where we've included a spin and mass error that's typical of the black holes, the measurements that are currently being done. And there's also less sensitivity to light masses because those produce smaller string signals, so you'll see fewer of the light black holes. If instead of giving the black holes 10 billion years to merge, where the superradiance condition cuts you off, or sorry, the superradiance condition stays the same, but the time that it takes cuts you off here. Now, if the black holes take 10 million years to merge, instead, this line moves a bit to the right, but you can still see that there's a significant deficit of rapidly spinning heavy black holes. So this hole is going to be quite observable. And if you're curious, you can, we can superpose the current measurements on here. So if it's a bit hard to see, the gray points up there are the X-ray binary measurements. And there are 6 points here with a huge error bars that are from LIGO. So these 2 are the first event that LIGO saw. The green ones are the 2 sigma detection, and the blue is the light detection. So depending on how excitable you are, I think this looks pretty nice. So we'll see. This will really, we're going to try to work out how much statistics you need to actually be able to see these signatures. And what particle masses will be sensitive to. Of course, that'll be very dependent on the black hole mass distribution at high masses and how many of those are actually out there in the universe. So we'll really care about how many heavy black holes we get.
Excuse me, Marsha.
Yes.
Can you remind us what are the prospects for measuring more accurately black hole spins in the future?
Yes, so currently the estimates are that you get the 90% confidence interval is roughly 0.8. It gets better if one of the black holes is much heavier than the other. It also gets better depending on the orientation and for lighter black holes. And also, it's better if you have higher SNR. So I think this is for SNR of order 10. If you have very high significant signals, then usually you'll do better. In past, I think to do significantly better, you need to go to next generation detectors. So there have been some estimates that have been done that in third generation detectors, so past advanced LIGO design, you can get 10% measurements.
Per individual event, but you can combine them.
Right, exactly. So we'll be getting, you know, roughly 1 new measurement a day. So with statistics, we've done estimates for scalar particles. So there you can, after a year of running, you'd be able to get evidence for this kind of shape. For vectors, you might be able to do even better because the signals are so striking that you spin down really almost to zero. So here we're going to be basing it on statistics, not on individual measurements.
So how does this depend on the spin orientations?
The error?
Yeah.
I forget exactly, but it's. I think it's bad if it's face on, if the binary is face facing you.
Did you mean spin orientation within the system, or it's that system's orientation relative to us?
Well, both actually.
For light black holes, it's you get better spin determination if you have precession, because then you can see a modulation of the signal that lets you disentangle that.
Right.
From some studies that LIGO people have done, it looks like for heavy black holes, that's not too important, and you just get the same errors regardless, basically because you see the ring down and you can get more information from that to break some of the degeneracies. And then, probably some people in the room know this better than I do. But
yeah, one problem is that what LIGO is able to do relatively well is to constrain the combination of both things.
Yeah.
And so the evidence that they are adding up to close to zero. And that's it. If you say that's unlikely, then you can constrain it much more aggressively.
Yeah.
Which is also why it's good to have one with a higher mass than the other, because then its spin will dominate.
Right. But so what do you think? So what's the A 90% is 0.8?
The confidence interval on the spin measurement is 0.8.
Right. But then if you assume some astrophysics in it, which is, it's very unlikely to have them kind of exactly or pretty much exactly number aligned with respect to each other, that number collapses to a much smaller value.
So this is just the LIGO sensitivity
right.
Measurement. Yeah, I agree. You can play with this more and try to get better results.
Yeah.
What you measure for the merging black holes is called the effective spin.
Right, yeah, that's what Luis was saying, is the projection is the best. Yeah. Yeah.
We just think
that's close to zero.
Right, exactly. So that's why these, that's why, yeah, that's why all these are consistent with zero. Yeah.
So let's hope it didn't continue this way.
Well, I don't know. We'll see.
I think that would be awesome. From our point of view, it would be awesome if it continues to be close to zero. But as for basically, now you have a huge issue, or you're going to have to call for these to order black holes.
Well, but it, as you have said, if it continues to be near zero, then everything is on the table.
That's good. Right. Yes. Yes. Yeah. So yeah, this is one possibility. And as you have all pointed out, this is, so the LIGO measurements will be kind of statistically based, and then future, very optimistically, with future detectors, you can get much better errors, and then you can, trace things out. We've heard that they might have detected something, but we're waiting. We're all waiting. It's good. Yes.
Not yet.
Okay. So, any questions on the spins? Cool. Was there something? No. Okay. So finally, there's.
So you guys haven't done yet the estimate of how many events it could take to
spin. No.
But the stats were.
That is in progress. Okay. So then there's gravitational wave emission from these huge particle states outside the black hole. Just like in an atomic system, like the analogy that Robert was describing earlier. You can have different levels being occupied, and you can have transitions from one state to the other. Instead of emitting photons like you do in an atom, you would emit gravitational wave radiation. And you can also have annihilations of two particles to gravitons. These turn out to be better signals in general, because you only need one level to be occupied, as opposed to two levels which grow together at the same superradiance rate but have different real parts of the energy. And both scalars and vectors, if they carry no conserved quantum numbers, can just annihilate away to gravitational radiation, with the black hole potential letting you conserve both energy and momentum in this 2-to-1 process. So let's look at the reach of how we would be able to see these signals. So again, these are gravitational wave radiations that are at the particle level, you can think of it as two particles annihilating to a graviton. Or you can think about the classical stress energy tensor of the whole mode emitting gravitational wave radiation. In either case, the frequency will be at twice the particle mass modulated by the binding energy. And here I'm showing the reach for scalars and for vectors. Scalars in blue, vectors in purple, and megaparsecs as a function of the particle mass. Unfortunately, vectors are awesome, but they're also awesome at being excluded. So here, the darker gray is the scalar constraint from X-ray binary spins. The lighter gray is, which also includes the darker gray, is the vector constraints from the X-ray binaries. So you can see vectors from much further away, but most of that space is already constrained. And to give you an idea, if we had the first black hole binary merger, final state was a 62 solar mass black hole that had a spin of 0.7. Here we're plotting 0.9, you would have been able to see a cloud around it from roughly 100 megaparsecs if it were a scalar particle, and roughly few thousands of megaparsecs if it's a vector. So you can basically see vector annihilations from all the way across the universe, which is pretty cool. This is assuming the optimal black hole for each particle mass. So we pick the best coupling that would give you the biggest signal for each particle mass. And for the solid lines and the dashed lines are fixing the black hole mass. OK?
Question?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Could you say a little bit more about why you expect all these huge number of particles to be coherently oscillating at the same frequency?
Yes. So I think, I don't know, you might have a quicker...
Effectively, it's because you're in a non-unitary system. You're continually losing information to the black hole. And the pointer states in that case, coherent states. So you expect to basically decohere to a coherent state basis rather than number state basis. In the same way that, you get radio waves when you're oscillating stuff around, you detect radio waves as coherent waves rather than number states of radio photons. You expect the same kind of thing to happen here.
And in particular, there are also energy eigenstates of, there's the coherence question and then there's the frequency question.
Sure.
So there's the frequency question that there are energy eigenstates of this potential. So the energy that we see being radiated away is exact as well.
So that would be the frequency for the.
Yes.
Yeah, but the phase
part. Has to be right.
Exactly, yeah. So it's not like an atom. It's not like an atom where you have like one electron or two electrons. You do expect to have a... This is not completely obvious. We should write this up, and we will. But because, unlike an atom, you're continually losing information to the center, you expect to decohere to a coherent state.
Another way to see this is that it's kind of like a detailed balance argument. Because every time, if you work with quantum mechanics, you have to have creation and annihilation of the radius. So every time you create n particles, there's a probability that some of them fall back into the black hole. Mm-hmm. So that makes basically effectively the number of particles fluctuate. And then this is the statement that eventually you end up with what is it?
To put it another way, your black hole is acting as a laser in some sense.
Yes.
You're getting stimulated sort of build up of this kind of thing.
Yes.
And you're building up in the same way that your laser builds up a very high occupation coherent state of photons. You're going to build up a very high occupation coherent state of these new bosons. I mean, none of these things substitute for actually doing the calculation,
yeah.
But you can do that calculation.
But as long as the key point here is as long as you have no time dependent perturbations, this is a true statement, the phase coherence is preserved. If you have time dependent perturbations, that will cause smearing of the frequency of the people. System. And that's why, for example, if you have a lot of stuff in the accretion disk or things like that.
So that spread out the energy, but you still expect to have decent phase coherence.
Well, it will be
yeah.
If you have a delta E, now that can affect the phase coherence as well, right? Because
so
if you have a spread in energy,
yes.
then the phase coherence, you can
yeah,
only be coherent in time.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's put it this way. You still expect it to look like a classical wave, just like a classical wave.
Yes. But you could have a large perturbation that just smears it to order one,
yeah.
Then the phase coherence is tight,
sure.
Right?
And you cannot self-recur from different modes?
It can. But the thing is that's why this is something else.
That's why we're insisting on weak coupling, in particular weak
yeah.
self-coupling as well. So in the scalar case, you can do these calculations and work out, let's say, for a QCD axion, in a certain mass range, the self-coupling is weak enough, in a certain mass range, it isn't. Here, for a vector, like if this was a dark photon, we'd have to assume a small enough kinetic mixing. Quite how small that small should be needs to be worked out, but small enough is going to be okay.
Yeah, you want to be dominated by the gravitational energy of the black hole.
And because the time scales, so because we're talking about exponential growth, if you have two levels that appear to have even by order one different rates, then they will end up with very different populations. So usually the time scale, the dynamics are only dominated by one level at a time. That also helps with phase coherence. Of course, this changes if you have self-interaction.
That's another story.
Another question?
Yeah, I'm trying to understand the interplay between the accumulation of your coherence
yeah.
and the gravitational.
That's a good question. Yeah, so it turns this doesn't necessarily have to be this way, but for this part of the parameter space, you're growing the cloud to the full size, and then you're annihilating away. So the time scales are such that annihilations are slower, but not much slower than the growth.
That'd be fast enough that you can understand.
Yeah,
see.
Right,
so
exactly.
In practice, black holes always have an accretion disk.
So
you're adding to the accretion around by
That sure. Well, black holes. Well, for example, the black holes that LIGO saw didn't have accretion disk. So not all black holes have accretion disk. But those that do, you know, this cloud is where basically you can treat it as non-interacting. So it just sits on top. And if the accretion disk gravitational perturbation is small enough, which is something that we check, then the cloud is not disturbed, and it just goes on its usual way.
So the practical way we detect this particles is through LIGO.
Yes, that is the most direct way. Yes.
So then my question is, what we get from LIGO is a waveform.
Yes.
Yes. So that's the only one we get.
Yes.
So how do you go in there and see these light particles?
That's a good question. So you can ask me again at the end, after the last two slides, because I'll give you a little bit more information. Right. So, okay. So this is the reach. We can try to turn this into event rate. So we're seeing, as we discussed, lots of long, coherent, monochromatic signals from these vector or scalar particles. So for vectors, we assumed some black hole mass and spin distribution. Again, unfortunately, all of this falls, pretty much all of it falls into the excluded region. We have a little bit sticking out here, depending on how many heavy black holes we get. So if you can see, it's a little hard to see here, but the difference between the solid and the lighter color is whether the black holes stop at 80 or 160 solar masses. We put a hard cutoff in addition to some exponential fall off. And this is kind of a two-peak distribution, so we're still working out the details here, but there's one peak that comes from the Milky Way, from very long, very faint signals that are black holes in our galaxy that have been emitting signals for many, many hundreds of years, or thousands, or even longer. And then there's a second peak here that are brighter signals from outside of the galaxy that are short and last for 10 days or so. Okay. And finally, So if you had a particle, or if you either found a way to get out of the spin constraints, which might happen if you start turning up the coupling, and then the effects of the accretion disk could mess up the clouds around with black holes that have accretion disks, but it may not affect these clouds in empty space. That's work in progress. Anyway, if you had found a way to weaken these constraints, or you can imagine there's a similar plot for scalars, if you do see events, you expect to see many events. You expect to see thousands of monochromatic signals, and you expect to see all of them clustered within twice the mass of the particle and minus the binding energy. So the binding energy will depend on what black hole it's around, and those will be within a few percent in frequency. So that would give you one sign that this is coming from something like a particle that has a fixed mass as opposed to a rotating neutron star that has that can have a order one variation in its frequency, depending on which rotating neutron star you look at. That's the other possible signal that could mimic this. Finally, if we get very lucky, we can also correlate two types of signals that LIGO would see. We get the binary black hole merger rate event. We see a new black hole that is usually quickly spinning, even if the two initial black holes are spun down, you still get the angular momentum of the system, so you get something like a spin of 0.7 or 0.8. And so the expected number of events per year as a function of the particle mass, assuming that we're only looking at the black holes which are formed in mergers that LIGO saw. So either black hole mergers make a new black hole, or black hole neutron star mergers, the pink ones here, making a new black hole. And then following up on that signal and seeing if a coherent monochromatic wave turns on shortly after the merger. And we might be able to see as many as 1,000 of those signals outside of the exclusion as well. And so that would be very exciting because, you know, the mass of the black hole, you know, the spin of the black hole, and you also see the frequency. So that tells you the mass of the particle, and you also see when the signal turns on after the merger. That gives you a lot of handles on what you expect the signal to be and would give you a bit more confidence in that this is the picture that you're actually seeing.
You also could put pair of binding neutron stars.
Huh?
You could
put there by the middle stuff.
Yeah, they'll be over here somewhere.
Well, oh yeah, they come four or five.
Yeah. So those will be lighter. They're a bit harder to see, and that would give you something here. So yeah, this band is actually assuming the measured rates. Given the three signals we've seen, this one is wider because it's based on simulations. And then if we go to future generation detectors, you see more and more. And basically, all these cutoffs here and here are mostly just the LIGO noise floor. So if we start building stuff underground or in space, then you might hope to extend this reach further.
And this has a nice feature that you could exclude things as well.
Right, yes.
I mean, it's hard to exclude the other blind searches because if we don't see it, we might be wrong about black hole mass distributions or something. Here, the specific black hole, we know its mass or whatever. So if we don't see the cloud, we didn't know.
Yeah. So yeah, you can, since these numbers of events are so huge and we know exactly what the black hole is, then we can start using these to constrain. Even with something like this, making a certain assumptions about black hole mass and spin distributions, you can start to constrain some parameter space and cross-check the spin limit. OK, so let's conclude. So we've discussed how we can use black holes to constrain ultralight particles, like scalars and vectors. And this is a part of parameter space that's normally wide open from lab experiments and other searches because they're so weakly interacting. And we already have constraints from spin measurements that exclude orders of magnitude and mass parameter space. And there is future hope to look in LIGO spin mass distributions and also gravitational wave signals to find signals of new particles. So thanks.
I'm asking my question again.
Yes.
Because in practice, we know how to calculate the gravitational waveform.
Yes.
And from Chern mass, the strain, and so on. So I'm trying to think of how you would see these things.
Right. So you're talking about the gravitational wave signals? Yeah, so these are actually already fall into a class of searches that LIGO is doing. So it's a particular, it's a single frequency wave. So you're just looking for a sine wave. Unfortunately, since we don't know where it's coming from, unless we look at some particular source, there's a lot of degeneracy that you have to break. Basically, you have to assume it could be coming from all possible directions with all possible velocities relative to us. And so it just takes a lot of computational power, but that's something that LIGO is already doing. So they already have searches from the initial run, and they've placed constraints. And those are looking for something like rotating neutron stars. The nice thing about this run is that hopefully they'll be going to lower frequency, which are more relevant for us. Here, right, this is just cut off at 10 hertz. So right now, their previous analysis stopped at 50, I think, just because I think it's easier for them to do lower frequency, right?
Yeah,
it
should
have
been.
Yeah.
So someone has actually calculated what happens when you put in a super radiance laser thing.
Yes, by accident. They didn't know they were doing super radiance, but yes, yes.
It's just a sine wave.
Yeah.
Someone's done this. Yeah.
Yes.
It's a monochromatic source.
Yeah.
It's not showing up in the
Inspiron.
Yes.
It's just a long-term.
Exactly.
Long-term sine wave.
So this is for looking for mountains on Newton's stars.
Mountains are not that high.
Yes.
We only observe the waveform in seconds.
Well, no, it's also right. So that's a beautiful thing about these signals, right? It's not just a trip for a second and then it's gone. It's something, it's a, you know, sine omega t, and it can last for thousands of years. So you go and you observe it here, and then you observe it, you know, a few days later and a month later, and then that gives. It is computationally difficult, but it is something that is currently happening.
Blocks.
Yeah.
They've been doing this since day one. What was one of the first searches? Because you see this wave that you can think of.
Right. So yeah, and you don't need complicated GR modeling of these systems, right? It's just a sine wave. Yep. Yeah. And Robert and I are over there if you guys have more questions.